Very important from the point of view of the biological aspect of reincarnation. there is an egg which has no experience whatever other than that coming to it in the place where it is. But a sperm represents a kind of life that swims about, gains experience, and is modified by the character of the stimuli that hit it. It then takes the modifications back and puts them into the egg, and the egg proceeds to divide them and to dispose throughout itself the formal inheritance. Now it's easy to see that as the paper, the white paper, represents the consciousness behind all forms, that when we're talking about reincarnation, we are talking about the re-embodiment of form. All the forms are in consciousness. Consciousness is represented here by the white paper. Form is represented by the marks we make upon it. So here is the egg, and we'll arbitrarily say, there is the germ cell, there is the somatic cell. But there's nothing in the germ cell there other than the formal inheritance from previous eggs. Now the essential part to realize is this. When the germ cell here divides itself and makes sperms in a man, or in the case of a woman, the ova, it never becomes a body. Only a bit of it. One little sperm will come out, and a lot more will come out, and they will attack a given egg and become a body. But always you have in the germ cells in yourself some of the original biological inheritance of your ancestors. That means that in the germ cells in yourself you already have incarnate, but not actuated on the external side, all your human ancestors and pre-human ancestors. Whatever in the evolutionary line led to man is in the germ present inside us. It is already incarnate there. Whether it expresses itself in the external world depends upon all sorts of external opportunities. If a man puts his sperm positor in a certain place and there is an egg to receive it, out of all the little sperms he releases, only one or perhaps two find a target. The rest of them perish, and they're all little formal packets, and the stresses in each one are different. So they're individuals, they're unique in stress, but their formal content absolutely is identical. Now inside the testes of the man we have here a generator making sperms all the time. If you take a cross section, cut it through the testicle, you'll find they're actually being made here as cells, and the nearer they get to the center here, the more they are becoming mature sperms with tails. When they are formulated properly, then they swim out and impregnate an egg. And the experience of the man, his intelligence, his nervous messages, are going down here and modifying the sperms as they're being manufactured, so that his reactions to his environment are sending messages down here, and the result is that there is modification of the sperms in the man, such that his thought is incarnating in those sperms. And if one of them impregnates an egg and a child results, that man's idea has incarnated in the child, and that is a biological fact. Butterflies do not beget elephants, so the formal content in the egg is carried forward biologically. Now this is one of the most important aspects, the ethical aspects of reincarnation, because it means in effect that when you give birth to an idea, remember the white paper represents consciousness. The consciousness here has seen certain ideas and has selected and stressed certain ideas for perpetuation. Those things to which you say yes in yourself, and those things to which you say no in yourself, both of them, both the hopes and the fears, produce modifications with spermatic changes, so that if you hope for a certain end, you present through the egg the child. And that child now is an incarnate idea that you chose. Now, the intelligence in which this body exists is eternal. So if we now say after a period of years it is decided that this brain system and this body of an individual man has served its purpose, it is allowed to disintegrate. That we call death. But the intelligence which allows it to disintegrate still exists. So, by resonance, if its evolution is not finished, it tends to seek a body. Every spirit seeks a body, is an esoteric rule. So, this being would then seek a body similar to the directions established by itself. It would therefore tend to incarnate in its own life. That's a future point. Which means that it would have to pay the price by being its own child in a future generation. So that whatever forces it releases here, which make children, when it comes to reincarnate to finish its evolution, by resonance law, it will tend to incarnate in its own mind, and it will then have to pay the price of the idea that it sowed in begetting that child. This aspect of it, the biological aspect, is not theoretical, it is factual. The other aspect we talked about, that you have two bodies, a gross material body and an idea body, and the idea body can disintegrate. It can disintegrate in the insane before the death of the physical body, and it can disintegrate after the death of the physical body, when a person has not tried to be logical and truthful with himself and knit all the ideas together. But if the man's desires are towards the earth, he will strive to get back into the physical body again. If his idea tendencies are already integrating sufficiently, he may try to integrate in the subtle body and not bother to go back into the gross material world. So we have two possibilities there, the incarnation into a physical body, which by resonance tends to be a body in which you yourself have a determinate influence. In other words, you are your own child. And you could equally well say that if we take the cycle of it, suppose that's your terrestrial father who had an idea and you became the idea embodied, and then after time he wanted to live, but meanwhile you've had a child and that's had another child, and this father comes into the same line and this child is begetting another, and so on. Eventually you can complete the cycle, and every man is his own father and child, given the necessary size of the cycle. So this whole question of the reincarnation must be considered in this way. The only thing that can reincarnate is form. Consciousness, represented by the white paper, remains eternally what it was, consciousness, indistinguishable from consciousness. So if you want to talk about distinguishing things, you must posit a differentiating factor in a soul. And the differentiating factor is necessarily form. The word idea, the word shape and form are all exactly the same. If we say there is a soul and put nothing in it, it is indistinguishable from another soul. If you want to distinguish one soul from another, well, there are two souls. We know there are two souls because their formal content is different. If this one has a child, the child will have a triangle in it. If this one has one, it will have the letter Y in it. And if the two are opposite polarity and joined together and produce a child, the child will have the triangle and the wine. The distinguishing factor is always form. So it is the form that is being repeatedly stated in various bodies that we are talking about when we reincarnate. If we don't have a reference point in us of an idea, a form, to which to refer, then to talk about reincarnation is just meaningless. We have a name, we refer to our name. If we can retain our name as a reference point so that we never lose that and can always return perpetually to it, we can talk about the perpetuation of our being because we have a reference point. But if we have no formal repeated pattern which we can recognize, then the whole idea of incarnation and reincarnation is meaningless. It is only form that reincarnates. Now, Mr. Helson said that we don't remember our past incarnations. Really, that doesn't prove anything at all, because we don't remember what we were doing this time in 1932 or 1929, so on. You can't remember much about your past life except the high spots, chief joys and chief fears, because there'd be no sense in remembering what cannot be used. So in fact, the question of whether we remember things from other lives is not really important, because we can't even remember this life very well. Nevertheless, there is a certain fact. All instinct in animals and in ourselves is directional. It is almost purposive. It's always trying to preserve the being. And consequently, we say that instinct involves reason. There cannot be an instinct in us except the trace of a previous rational judgment that was made at some time past. Now, every baby is born with a capacity for drinking milk from its mother's breast. And yet, that baby, if by that baby you mean that particular physical form, with an arbitrary definition, but it has begun to exist now, that baby has an instinct, and yet it's had no experience. That instinct is only the involved rational experience of its ancestors. And if we look at this diagram again, there is the father who had experience of being suckled, who puts a formal trait in a sperm, so that when the child comes out, the experience of the father is involved in the child, and the child knows how to suck. Now, every instinctive process we've got, which is purposive, is derived from a once conscious rational judgment, which by repetition has become involved, become habitual and unconscious. And when it has become unconscious in that way, and yet is related to life, then we call it an instinct. But an instinct is a degenerated reason, a reason that has become unconscious, and yet it still retains its purpose. So all the instinctive life in us is simply the reincarnated behavior patterns that have proved useful. If you get a chick when it's first born, you can play, do various things. And if a shadow of a large bird falls over it, it will immediately run back to the mother. Yet that little chick has not been eaten yet by a hawk. But really it has, because as we saw before, when the germplasm there is putting out a little bit of itself, it's not putting all of itself out, there is always some of the germplasm left in us, and it is identical with the original germplasm in our parent egg, which also never became the body, but only some of it did, this part. And consequently, through the germplasm, there is a continual line of descent back to all our ancestors. And our ancestral experience form is actually incarnate in us now, which means that there is actually a method of remembering previous incarnations, namely by feeling your instinctive life and moving backwards into the instinctive life to try to find out its source. What happens if you take an instinct and deliberately hold it and feel it? Gradually there begin to arise in consciousness certain experiences which may become visual. You may actually then see the situation in which that instinct was first developed. And because your consciousness is a formal one, and only through formal consciousness can you be individuated, at the point at which you can remember that experience, it is yours, and you have remembered a previous life experience. So the only thing we have to be careful about is this. In considering reincarnation, we are talking about a primary cosmic egg. That primary cosmic egg divides itself. And each one of those divisions constitutes a nation. And the divisions of those individuals, the divisions of those tinier, down to particular persons that we know. And nevertheless, the contact with the original cosmic egg is not lost. So that the whole formal content of the cosmos is actually involved in peoples, nations, families, individuals, down to each particular. And it is only a question of increasing sensitivity, feeling, to be able to remember your family instinctive heritage, your national one, your terrestrial one, if you like, your fantasy one, your solar one, and your macrocosmic one. All these are involved, and we are evolving, getting back to it. And we evolve without by increasing our sensitivity. So, in considering incarnation at all, we have to consider what incarnates is the consciousness focus on a form. But if we remove the form absolutely, there is nothing to be incarnated. So that if we want to remember any past existence, the way to it is through the instinctive life. Now you know Carl Jung's psychology has formulated the theory of the collective subconscious. And in this, which was forced upon him by his clinical experience, it became apparent to him that people who never met each other before had similar contents in the unconscious. And the facts force him to say there is a kind of group mind, a racial mind. This racial mind is stocked with forms. And those forms, at certain levels of consciousness, which may be reached by hypnosis, or by simply beginning to drowse and talking carelessly, freely, free association, gradually the racial memory comes to the surface, and you begin to perceive things which are actually engrammed in your assumptions. You can remember then your ancestors of 1,000, 5,000 years ago or more. There is no question here of a time sequence going backwards, because time is only the product of rotation. The question is entirely one of becoming more and more sensitive to what is inside us. As we increase our sensitivity, we come across different layers of form. The most obviously external ones are those we have seen or are seeing now in this room today. If we try to remember where we were a year ago, it becomes vague. If you try to remember what you were doing when you were 4, you might have one or two little memories. If you try to remember what you were doing when you were 2, when you were 1, when you were first born, it becomes very, very vague. But nevertheless, it's a physical fact that every experience you've ever had is engrammed on your organism and can be reclaimed. Not as fantasy, as fact. Under deep hypnosis, you can remember your earliest childhood memories and also your parental memories, because there is no division in the germplasm between you and your ancestors. This germplasm has been handed down from the beginning and has never yet been wholly used up in bodies and destroyed, which means that the sex cells in us now are the original germplasm from Adam and whatever it was that involved itself into the form of man. So the question of verifying such a matter can only be by increase of sensitivity. It's quite useless to talk about accepting reincarnation as a fact unless you increase sensitivity, because a fact is an act of perception. So if reincarnation is to become a fact for us, it can only be by increasing our sensitivity. Otherwise it must remain a theory. But if you increase your sensitivity, and particularly through the instinctive life, and the most strong part of that is the sexual life, through sexual fantasies you first discover that you are determined largely by types, that you prefer a certain kind of opposite number, a dark one, a short one, a fat one, a thin one. These are preferences that you did not make, they were in you. And your preference for the opposite sex is simply the engrammed resultant of all the sexual experiences of your ancestors. And as the sexual instinct is the most strong one, then obviously it is the nearest one for beginning to remember, because it's most closely linked to the instincts which are the involved rational experiences of your ancestors. So that's the way to tackle that problem. There's another question here about shapes and forms and so on. We have to repeat again that whether we use the word idea or form or shape, what we are referring to is whatever is circumscribed. This is Greek, this is Latin, and this is Saxonese. In the word idea is simply that we are dividing primary substance. To analyze primary substance, the I, the D, division, air, means primary substance. Form implies pila. This FR is PR, a substance in which there is pi ratio, a rotationary function. And the difference between this and this is that the Greek mind is analytic, is only cutting the thing up, but the Roman mind wanted empire. So it always insists on this limit and the arm of authority, the radius going round to that limit. In the case of this, with English word shape, you see the word ape in it, it's very interesting. This actually means spirit, softly coming in to make an ape of God. Now, you've heard often enough the title of Adam as an ape of God, because he said, I'll eat the fruit and be like God. But as an individual, he wasn't God, he was only like God. Therefore, he was called an ape of God. And the word shape, it says that the absolute spirit applied itself on a point of feeling. And there is nothing in the ape except the potentialities of the spirit. So if we like to write the SH over there, with a circle around it and a little circle for the ape, that is the doctrine called the doctrine of signatures. Spirit has objectified itself, and whatever is objectified is simply a copy or an ape of spirit. So we see in the case of this English word that the idea is that there is spirit objectifying itself, and that the object is only the subject reflected. So it is a copy. So in this idea, it says, forms are copies of spiritual absolute reality. This one says forms are zones of influence, power. The Romans are interested in power. This one says that forms are modes of dividing primary substance. But in all cases we are concerned with the circumscription of whatever shape, doesn't matter. All these are forms simply because they are circumscribed. Now, when we are thinking in the mind. So, TH, let's see, crossing in the spirit in the earth, that earth body, that apparently solid body, hits upon us and produces in another being, see, a think. So that the shadow of the thing in a subjective sentient being is called a think. So if we say there is a soul which is sentient, here is a stimulus from a 10-pound weight, there's a reverberation in there from the stimulus, this reverberation is thinking. Thinking is simply the reaction of that sentient substance to the gross stimulus. The thing begets to think. And the thinking is always a formal process. You can easily see that if this is a straight line here, when it hits there, it will propagate fairly straightly. And the terms of it there will produce in here a spreading out of a shape like this. So, in fact, the yoga statement about the mind in thinking is quite true. The mind assumes the form of the object. If I give a triangular stimulus to it, this line will arrive first and start travelling, this one will arrive a bit later and travel, and this one will arrive, and so on. So that a triangle will be built up inside the sentient substance. So thinking is simply the assumption by a sensitive substance of consciousness of the form of the stimulating object. So there is no thinking whatever other than formal processes arising in a sentient substance. So the whole question then raised in this series is just precisely what is the nature of this thinking as opposed to the thinking process. Let's look at the idea of Christ as a super thought. There is the glyph. Now this is the letter O, and that's the active and that's the passive in the earth. The O signifies all that is, the cosmic boundary. This signifies the active, this signifies the passive. We shade the bottom part, let it represent substance, and the top part we can let it represent consciousness. This is now the objective, and that's the subjective half of the whole being. Now, the macrocosmic form is the Logos, the Christ. It is form. It is said to be the Saviour because it saves us from non-form. Now, non-form is the same as lostness. If we have no form at all, we have no reference. If we have no reference, we cannot gather ourselves together. So if we are floating vaguely about without any determinate edges and don't know where we're going, that is, as Carradine would have said, an eternal search for a non-determinate. All you feel then is a vague searching for you know not what. Now, to be saved from that, you must set up a sharply defined form. The moment you have set up this form, which covers all derivative forms, you have then a permanent reference, something that will enable you to go through all derivative ideas with this master concept. This master concept is saving us from this vague wishy-washiness. Now, it is a fact that we have in us a strong feeling that we ought to be doing something, even if we don't know what. This feeling of ought to be doing something, we say, is the natural, teleological aspect of man. Man is a purposive being. Long before he knows why, he knows that he is. As he gradually comes from this vague fluffiness into form, he gradually becomes aware that he can control the situation. And he has a feeling of fulfillment. Now, the idea of fulfillment is filling Fullman. And you can't fill this stuff, this is infinite fluff. Concepts of filling is meaningless to that. But if we want to fill, we must circumscribe. And then, once we've made the first circumscription, we feel hollow inside. We can feel the vague fluff outside. And the thing is to put something inside us which will be a permanent and eternal reference. And when that is completely filled in us, we can say we are fulfilled, filled full of saving form. So the question of Christ, the cosmic Logos, being the Saviour and fulfilling the process of evolution, is simply in that it fills the soul full of saving form. Now, save is the same as saving, you've got to know. In order to avoid this fluff, if you have the necessary savvy, you can save yourself. But that form has already been made macrocosmically before we exist. So we don't have to fabricate it from nothing. It has already been fabricated for us. So when we come to look at the universal symbol of this order, we are actually causing the fluff, the wool, the vague meanderings of unformulated forces to come into order and begin to rotate. When things rotate, a cycle is set up, and that is the basis of recognition. And recognition is the basis of our salvation. When we can recognize a situation in its type and in its variance, we can control it. If we don't recognize it, recognize, which is to make again a cog in the hole, we can't control it. So if we learn and make absolutely certain that we understand the implications of circumscription, we know that whatever is presented to us as a problem is necessarily formed. If we take the prob and problem, the word prob, as he is when he needs it. A problem is any formal situation, substance, into which you can insert a probe. And with the aid of that probe, you sort it out, you separate it. And when you have seen all the elements and their relations, you have transcended the problem. You have probed it and seen all the relations. It is no longer problematic to you. It may be problematic to another person who has a problem, but it isn't problematic to you. So the meaning of this master concept of the Logos is that it enables us to force the infinite chaos into a recognizable form, and then to use that form as a filter, so that whatever other energies are presented to us, we have a means whereby we can force those energies to rotate. And in the rotation, they repeat. And in the repetition becomes familiarity, awareness of what they are, and through that arises control. So the more often we see an idea, the more familiar we are with it, the less it frightens us. And if we become aware of the parts of an idea, right down to the base level, then it's no longer problematic to us. And the thing can only not be problematic if we probe it to the limit. We can discard a problem by refusing to face it, but it still is a problem for us. That is to say, if it represents itself in a situation, we will have to either turn away from it and reject it again, in which case it will come again later, or we'll have to hit at it and find out what it is. So, in this question about form, pyramid is a material replica of the hierarchy concept. That is a universal shape. It says here, when Christ was teaching his disciples, was he creating a universal form of perpetuation? Well, if we take Christ, the German word Christ means this circle, and we put the T on it, there is Christ, there's T. Now that is the Christ. The Krishna in the Indians is the same thing. We have the circumscription, we have the analytical active force, and the passive substantial aspect of it. We apply this in every situation, and we must have a formal process which we call a ritual. Religious rituals are simply the right way of analyzing a situation. It doesn't matter whether it's a human being or a material or a relation between materials, a situation, political or philosophical. Whatever it is, you must say to yourself, what are the limits of this situation? What are the actives in the situation? And what are the passives in the situation? And if you make yourself verbalize this fact, then there comes into the mind gradually the power to penetrate down to the ultimate element of the situation. And the sticking the verbal colour in is probing into the situation. Every situation that's not yet been probed is problematic. And every situation into which you insert the words, which is the active, which is the passive, what is the limit, and so on, you are breaking it down and making it non-problematic. So, let's think about this idea again. Here is another version of it, we've done it before. In the orb, with the cross over it, you find the monarch holding in her hand. This symbolizes the being as it was. This horizontal cuts off the bottom and leaves a cup of primary urge unanalyzed. Top half splits into two, one for liking and one for disliking, one for yes and one for no. And coming out of the center and springing straight up is the cross, which symbolizes the idea, the form upon which you are pinned. Now, tremendously important is conceptualization. Conceptualization means holding a concept of yourself such that your action is determined. Supposing we take a little boy, hear a great violinist, and he's never heard one before, and he's fascinated by this performance, and he sees 5,000 people stand up and cheer for them. Straight away he can see that he's going to be a violinist, and so he insists on having a fiddle ball for him. He hasn't thought about the work, he's just thought about the acclaim. So he has a concept now, I am a great violinist any moment now. So he plays the devil with his daddy until he gets a fiddle. Then he goes home and starts scraping. It doesn't sound the same. When it doesn't sound the same, he tends to think perhaps there's something else he ought to do, playing the tin whistle. So it pushes the concept of the great violinist to one side. It still exists. It's just a concept of success that he had as a result of a stimulus situation. Now, in order to become free, we have to liberate ourselves from concepts that are no use, which we have acquired since we were born, and our ancestors have acquired for us in the past through similar stimulus situations. So when we are examining ourselves, we should ask ourselves what concept we have of ourselves. Do we consider ourselves decent types, hard-working types, thinking types, emotional types, and so on? And using a verbal formula, find out your concept of yourself, which is the same thing as your governing form. Try to find out where you got it from, and try to find out whether it's worth having. If it's really worth having, it doesn't really matter where you got it from. But it's quite a good idea to know where you got it from in most cases, because usually the concept you have of yourself is very unreal and isn't much related to your own individuality. So in conceptualization, let's have a look. You say that step is like you are cutting yourself and tying together little bits and trying to make form. There is your primary self with no concepts in it, just a potentiality of anything. And along comes the fiddler and hits you with a stimulus, and the fiddle appears in you. You identify with it. And the success and the acclamation have made you your old fiddle shape inside. Then it means you have cut out and tied together with yourself this concept of the fiddler. But in so doing, in stressing that concept, you have subdued your infinite potentialities in other fields. This means that every particular concept that you get of what you might do is actually inhibiting infinite possibilities that you haven't even thought about. I know lots of little kiddies in the last 7 years, they have told what they were going to be. There's been at least a couple of dozen famous things already. And it depends entirely on the nature of the stimulus that hits them, what they're going to be. One little girl just this last 2 days suddenly decided to use another name that she had. And I asked her today, why have you changed your name? And she said, I don't know. I said, if you will go and look at the card that your mother has got, you'll see that the name you've chosen is on that card. And the particular card is a match from a beer house. You see? Which somebody had brought in, pinched it so it was colourful. And it said on it, Joan. And it said, the girl drinking baby sham. Mm-hmm. Joan likes her bubbly. Suddenly this girl thought, her name is Joan. Because this drawing is a little match. So she dropped all she thought about herself and suddenly started signing her letters. Joan, because she wanted to look slim and drink baby sham. She had no idea what either meant. She looked very pretty and careful. That was the beginning of a conceptual self. When I told her how she had come to do that, I said, well, I'm not going to do it. If that's what it is, she got that going. She won't do it again. But if that had been examined on her for a few years, she wouldn't have been able to stop it. It would have been very difficult. So it means that the concepts you've had for very many years are going to be hard to shift. You have favourite ideas and they've been derived from all sorts of famous successful people. You've identified with them since you were kidding. They may or may not have something to do with you as a person. If they haven't, they'll never mature. If they have something to do with your essentially unique stress, then it's all right. Most of them have. When you analyze the concept you hold in yourself,
tried to find its source. See whether it's really worth having. If it is, all right, rethink it. Consciously as an aim. If it isn't, get rid of it. And the way to get rid of it is to find the superior concept to it and start putting the energy into the new one. Don't waste time battling the old one. Just rub it again in.
Where the ideas are, we can write truth. Can we conceptualize ourselves honestly of truth to people? Can we say, I tell the truth to myself? Never mind what you tell anybody else. Can you say, I always tell the truth, the objective truth to myself? Your ideas, then, are truth. That is a worthwhile concept. Because truth relates to government law. Government law is essentially efficient. Therefore, truth is efficient. Now, the truth and the truth shall make you free. So, to tell yourself the truth about yourself, whether you tell it to anybody else or not, to tell yourself the truth about yourself, is to release infinite energies inside there for real work. Whereas if you have an untruth in yourself, it means that you're suppressing the truth and putting false stresses in part of your thought content. So a very good concept, a worthwhile one to have, is that you are an internally truthful person, that you don't lie at least to yourself. That's good. Then, down below here, there is the good. And we'll say this relates to physical action. Are the actions that you do good actions? Now, a good action is always one that produces the results that you aim at. Good is the same thing as efficient. Truth is the same thing as the form that is in the efficient. And good is the energy that you're applying to push that form into action. So we talk about goodwill. The truthful mind and the goodwill in action. And between those two arises beauty. That's Plato's true, good, and beautiful. And that is a threefold concept worth having. Do you feel in your feeling beautiful? Which means, look at the O in the middle, the fence from water, fence that I've already. That O is water. Means smooth action. Do you feel if you've got a lot of jabber in you, or step out of action to knock everybody down? Or do you feel that you can flow into your purpose? That flowing into purposes without jar is beauty. It arises between goodwill and the truthful mind. So we have a threefold concept. We can do a glyph of it if we like, and we can put the good up there, and the truth there, and the beauty there. That will then be God the Father, and then be the Son, and then be the Holy Ghost. Truth represents the Logos, the Son. Good represents the primary will. Beauty is the issuant feeling, the tension between the goodwill and the truth thought. Now that concept can be applied and is a tester to see what kind of concept you've got. And remember, in these cases, we have to verbalize it. It's no good leaving it vague. We must say in words to ourselves, do I tell myself the truth about myself? Remember, at this stage, it doesn't matter whether you tell the truth to somebody else. That will come later. Sometimes you may tell the truth, and other times you may shut up. There comes a time when you won't tell a lie to anybody. You'd rather shut up than speak, because you don't want to falsify the records in your own mind. But in the early stages, it's sufficient for you to say, am I being truthful with myself? Truth relates to the form of the matter, good to the power, and beauty to the flow of that power through the form. So you can see efficiency, the outer working of all these, is very intimately linked together. So let's consider motive. In motive we have an end purpose, an idea. That idea is a guide. We want to get somewhere. And then we put the power into the form and begin to move the body in the manner determined by the idea.
If you want to drive a nail in the wall, we use a hammer. That's a screwdriver. It's a screw, we use a screwdriver, not a hammer. The end result is the form that determines in what manner we can use the nail. If we use the will smoothly with the proper form, the act is said to be beautiful. But we must verbalize this relation. We can't do it merely by regulating and roughly truthful, vaguely good, and somewhat useful. Won't do. We've got to get down in every situation in which we find ourselves from moment to moment and say, am I being truthful with myself? Because if I'm not, there's my brain, frozen of a certain shape. In fact, outside, I look at it and say, it's a triangle. I say, but I don't like triangles. So I think I'll make that very, very faint and I'll go over it with a square very strongly. Now, I cannot eliminate this fact, which is reflected in my mind. But I have the power to say it is a square, when it is really a triangle. And I can go on shouting, it's a square, it's a square, it's a square, until eventually it dominates consciousness. But it has not eliminated that triangle. Now, every individual act, and it's only an individual act that can be untrue, every individual act that makes an untruth by false stress does a peculiar thing. It lasts only as long as the individual can concentrate on the falsity. And when his energy falls off, then his individual false stress begins to become faint. And the energy he used to suppress the triangle begins to go into the triangle. And then he finds a shadow coming up in the mind of what he's been trying to get rid of, truth. All that we call repression and so on, psychologically, is nothing else but an attempt to cover up an unpleasant fact. And when the individual energies tire, then this unpleasant fact works back into consciousness. These repressed, unpleasant truths frequently cause accidents. They cause people to do things that they don't want to do. Individually, they may say, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to believe this. And when they become individually tired, the thing that they don't want to do comes gradually forward as their false stress recedes, and then it seizes the motor zones and releases action, which is then called action. So that is a definition by the individual. It's really essential action which has been temporarily held in check by the individual. So we have to remember that if we don't verbalize exactly what we are doing, we cannot be truthful with ourselves. And if we're not being truthful with ourselves, it follows that our mind is falsified in all its formal content. And we have the three processes. There's the true, there's the beautiful, and there's the good. We test this will simply. That will, is it driving or isn't it? Yes, is it driving or isn't it? If it's awake, should be driving, positive. Some say, am I really putting my energy into it or not? Be truthful about that and say, no. Because that is either positive or it's asleep. It's never negative. And then you test your feelings by saying, am I for it or against it? Remember, it's very, very simple down here. Am I putting my energy into it? There's only one answer to that question. Yes, or it's not in at all, it's asleep. And on this one, do I like it or don't I? That's very simple too. Yes, am I saying yes or no? Supposing my energy is awake, I say yes, I'm definitely driving. Then I say, well, do I like it or don't I? Then I must say yes or no to the situation. If I say yes, then my energy is driving to establish it. If I say no, my energy is driving to destroy it. And when I come to the idea, an idea is always complex. You've seen it before, it is an analyzed substance. So that the idea is already cut up into bits analytically. Therefore, there are many things to consider in the idea.
But we've said before that if you break a thing down into its ultimate elements, to each element you can say yes or no. And to each conjunction of elements you can say yes or no. The apparent complexity is in the idea. In the feeling it's only yes or no, and in the prime drive it's only yes when it's awake. So you have a conceptual method there, which if you verbalize, you can test yourself on the inside. And you know that if you are to succeed in a given situation, your will must be towards success in it. There, I like it. And then you must be absolutely truthful. That is, you must state the formal content of the situation. And if you do those three things, it follows that there must arise a harmony in the body. Because your form is right, your feeling is right, and your will is right. The whole of the Buddhist procedure is derived by a simple extension from this simple fact, right thinking, right action, and so on. It's just a simple statement of the threefold nature of man.
How does stealing relate
to stealing? You mean appropriating commodities?
Oh. The appropriation commodities
at the ordinary level, but it's non-stealing, you know. Oh yes, well that's because obviously if you had a concept of stealing, you must have a concept of property, mustn't you?
Yes.
Let's take this idea again. That's the whole matter of cosmic being. And there is one man and there is another man. And here are some non-animate objects round about. This man here is a yogi, and he's undertaken to pin himself and to introvert and refine his perceptions so that he becomes aware of the whole. And this man isn't, he's a materialist, very desirable, and he's a martial man. So he rushes about and he collects all these little things and puts them around them like this. He now declares them to be his property. He's telling lies, actually. Because property means that which is one's own, the corporeal, essentially. And what is really owned cannot be taken off you. Everything can be taken away from you, just doesn't belong to you. Doesn't matter what it is, your crown, your throne, your shoes, whatever can be stripped off you is not your own, essentially. So a militarist who gets an empire together and says, this is my empire, he's just a liar. And the yogi who is trying to get cosmic consciousness would refute his own purpose if he were to start collecting these material bits. So, as this man has defined them as his property and says that anybody who takes them is stealing, if this yogi takes them, he has forgotten his own purpose. That's entirely matter of logic in the process. There's also another statement that a yogi must not receive gifts from others. Not only must he not steal, he mustn't receive gifts. Now again, here is a man and he says this is his. He says. And then he gets hold of it and he brings it over here and says, I give you this. Now if that yogi accepted his definition that it was his and that this was a gift, again he would falsify his position. The yogi knows that those things belong to the macrocosmic self with which he is identified. If this being thinks they're his and brings them across and gives them, and the yogi accepts the definition, then he's forgotten his universal purpose. But if that man brings those things over there and says, these would do for the propagation of so-and-so, then that yogi will say, yes, they will do for that propagation. If this man says it's a gift, the yogi will say, yes, it is a gift, perhaps, but not from you as an individual. Through you, the macrocosmic self goes like that. Therefore, in yoga, it says the origin of all gifts is the Lord, the macrocosmic self. Because unless this man believes in that in some way, he can't get an impulse in him to want to further the propagation of the idea. So again, that yogi must not imagine that that is an individual gift if he's to accept it. Because if he thinks it is, he will take with him the private purposes of the man who gives the gift. And the man will impose on him and say, now you must do so-and-so because I have made you a gift. Now the Germans are quite aware of this because that word in German means poison. That gift means poison. Because the Germans like to be power men as individuals. And if another fellow is in the position to give you something, that's bad. You should be able to take it. So it means poison. These psychological insights from the structures of the languages of different nations are very important. So that gift means poison, and that poison, coming out the Poisson of the French, has only one more S, and the French are rationalists. Fish pertain to the emotions overthrow reason, and therefore there's a very close relation between this poison of the English and the Poisson of the French. Because to them, the fish, which symbolise all the emotions, poison the intellect. So, in this process, you see, in yoga there are a series of things you mustn't do. But they all relate to this primary idea. We've said that the good is always that which subserves the attainment of an end. If it is the purpose of that yogi to become cosmically conscious, he cannot afford to accept private individual definitions of what is and is not. If he does, he'll lose his aim. But providing he's quite clear, then all right, whatever happens inside, he can define it within his concept. Now, if we take the highest metaphysics of the Indians, the Advaita school, which is non-dualistic, then, supposing this is Shankara, the great Advaita, and somebody comes to him and says, I give you something. Shankara says, who are you? Are you not myself? How can I give myself something? Already it is mine. Is it to be used in this place or that place? Because all these places are in me. Now that is the Advaita position. It's absolutely non-dualistic. And the question of the distribution of commodities inside the whole non-dual is simply a matter of intelligence. Is that being wasted over there? Can it be used here? If an individual thinks it's better to appropriate it and hide it there and not use it, he's suffering from a misconception. If another fellow over here said, he is abusing that, and I'm going to take it off him, he'd be a bad yogi. Robin Hood, in that sense, is not a very good yogi, because he makes private judgments about whom he should rob. The man with the non-dual consciousness who's saying all outside and in and every individual are not really different essentially knows that the whole is working through each to produce a pattern that evolves the consciousness of all individuals within it to higher levels. So if anybody wants to leave a sage over there to starve, that sage won't object. Because he'll say, all this is conspiring to starve me. And in that starvation there, there will be a witnessing of an effect over the whole process. And he'll be quite satisfied to do it. When Christ goes on the cross, he knows that the effect of that cross for thousands and thousands of years on the minds of men will be colossal. So if an individual suffering there and being defeated, in effect, by getting in the position where he can be defeated publicly in that way, has conquered the world. His idea, his concept, today is problematic. One unknown man, 2,000 years ago, behaved in a certain way. Today, after all that time, philosophers and religionists can't let go of the man. Every year they produce a new book to prove something about him that didn't exist, or if he did it, it was another man. And so, the fact is, they cannot leave him alone. So, whatever he was, he did something that in effect has forced all men to consider it by accepting a situation that most men have done. So, the whole question in the non-dual analysis says that whatever is presented to you, you will know how to deal with it when it comes. The question of stealing and receiving a gift may be a false definition by individual. And if it is, the non-dualist will penetrate to it.
Grouping complexes, detail, and thinking forward is so
Well, you can see why. Supposing we draw a line, say that line represents a section through this paper, and we imagine the whole thing continued infinitely in all directions. We then have sameness. Now, there's no value whatever in sameness. And if we want to produce a difference, and there is nothing else to introduce, it means a manipulation of what is. Nothing else. All we can make is a form of change. So we take the thing and bend it. We've now got a new form, we bent that. In the process, we have something to look at we didn't have to look at before. That is a form. The universe, whatever it is nothing but a system of form. The brain of a child is smooth, sheepish. The sheep's brain stays smooth. So the child's brain is peculiar, it starts folding itself like this. As it gets older, the convolutions become more and more complex. And the degree of its complexity is the degree of its normal content. And that is the same thing as the degree of its capacity to deal with situations. Every time we put another fold in, we have a new form of knowledge and a new capacity to deal with a situation. So really the whole universe is complicated. It can be with fold. So you can see that it's essentially simple. There is nothing more simple than the fact that that piece of paper, simply folding it like that, presents us with a new form of situation. The paper has not altered. The fold is the complication. And there isn't any complication in the whole universe other than the foldings of forces. So we need never be frightened by complexity, because they're just fold. So all we do is just pull the thing out straight. In other words, we pop it, the primary continuum, and ask ourselves, what is the formal way in which this particular one has been folded? It then undoes itself. The fact that the PL in the flex, and it's the final one, shows our fundamental glyph. All parts of space are simply repositories. The points in space are the intersections of these overlapping zones of stress strain. The point is a stress. The perimeter is a strain. Multiply those circles infinitely in all directions, and you have the complex universe. And it's simply a matter of stressing a thing like that, which exists eternally, that produces a finite pattern. The infinite, which is eternal, is pulsing throughout it. If we stress one particular part of it, it makes a whole, a complex. Essentially, it's simply a circle propagated throughout infinity. When we see that fact, all the stresses of particular situations fall down into a simple overstressing in the time process of an eternal configuration which is never different. It means the same effect that every individual man on earth is identical essentially with the other. And he differs from other men only in the way he is stressed, complex way that he is conceptualized. So if we take two identical twins, we know that their reactions are remarkably similar because they're the same age split. If we give them two totally different educations conceptually, we can make it impossible for them to communicate at the intellectual level by teaching one German and the other Chinese. They wouldn't be able to talk to each other. But biologically, they would still be resonating together. They would still show the same illnesses during the same periods of life, because they're the same age. So they would be essentially identical and formally different. And in the same way, when it says God has made of one blood all nations, all the peoples on earth are essentially identical, but the formal stresses imposed upon them by the spermatic experiences involved in the eggs and propagated are the only differentiating factors. But it's only a question really of letting go of that. And if you realise what Christ said, if you try to preserve your life, your individual life, you will lose your cosmic life. But he who is prepared to lose his individual stress life will find his real cosmic life. The real cosmic life knows all about all the potential stresses of everybody. Whereas the particularly stressed individual knows only those things that resonate with his particular stress.
And what would his function be once he got
Well, to propagate the cosmological idea. To try to get as many as possible to get to that higher level, because it is better. Because even efficiency is better than inefficiency. And the individually stressed man is blind to all the parts that he hasn't stressed.
So that even in arriving at the higher place, his activities are determined.
Determined?
Well, he will want to get to that higher place, elect to do that.
Ah, yes. Yeah. And not mechanically determined.
No. Oh, but he will elect to do that.
He may. He's having that.
Or could he elect not to do it?
Oh yes, he can. He's a free being. He would have a very peculiar reason for refusing it, wouldn't he?
Well, what would happen then? He would lose his position.
Well, he would just isolate himself.
He couldn't have a private reason.
Not to be detained,
no.
Yet it's not the same thing as a mechanistic position. If he's gained that point, and feel free to decide to cooperate.
Saying a man wishing for cosmic consciousness decides to use the orthodoxy of an existing pattern, the opposition of that orthodoxy, to oppose it, say like Nietzsche did. Would you say, with the case of a man like Nietzsche, that he was quite aware in opposing the existing dogma that he was accelerating his own growth? Or would you say that because he broke down in the process, that there was some other motive behind his initial drive?
Yes, well, I would say that the whole of Nietzsche's writings show an individual stress.
But towards...
There's a capital I line towards that. It's an individuated stress, and it must break eventually. You see, Nietzsche couldn't have written the Antichrist in the way he did, unless he had misunderstood it.
Not like Blake, then. Not like Blake, who had made the statement that the people, or most of the people, are worshipping Lucifer under the name of Jehovah.
No, because Nietzsche is essentially a negator. He writes about affirmation all the time because he's a negator. All his work is an attack on existing forms.
Yes.
He's not doing what Paul said. He's not steadfastly affirming the good. He's very, very vigorous at denying the evil. He's chosen a negative process.
How does this differ from Kierkegaard, is it?
Kierkegaard has a position where he, by looking at the temporal process as such, he says there is no salvation in it.
As such?
As the temporal process as such.
I see.
There cannot be salvation in
it. So the way to do it as such.
Oh, sorry.
In the way to do it. In the everything is breath of a machine that expresses nothing in metaphysical pessimistic way, as they shed and pursue in Nirvana, to get rid of their expression of strength, and just as big as to find nothing as everything.
Well, there again, there are two ways of looking at the Buddhist phenomenon. Some people think that Nirvana is an illusion, but it was not originally taught so. People can become tired of life and be glad to sink into the ground, providing they're not in pain, and just forget the whole thing. Providing they're not in pain, they would like to just float away into nothing. And then they will obviously say no, because pain means a refusal. They must refuse it. In the case of the positive aspect of Nirvana, it means not being driven about by thirst, by desire. To attain a level of balance above desire drive.
Is it possible to understand these things before considering this crisis on the planet?
No.
See,
if you remove crisis, it means crosses. There must be forces cutting across some concept that you've got. The force must break your concept, that's the crisis. Crisis is a cross.
Take the end result of anything is known when you do it. And you see, there's no purpose in doing it. And there's other forces, say, it's conscious efficiency that's pushing that direction.
If you really see the end of an action, and you've really no purpose in doing it, and you persist in doing it, you can call it inertia.
But say, the people involved.
Well, that depends. Are you considering those other people and doing it for a cause?
Yes.
Is that out of compassion for those other people?
It might be in the name of efficiency.
Well, then you have a purpose that is worth your doing. If it's done in the name of efficiency and you are allowing that thing to develop out of consideration for other people.
And you must then be listening to standing, listening to yourself,
Well, you know, one of the funniest things about consideration of others is frequently that it can disguise consideration of oneself. One may have an opinion of oneself and hope that other people have that opinion, and may act in a way called considering other people in order that they don't have a bad opinion.
Yes, I see that.
And when that occurs, well, it just means that you're working to substantiate an untrue concept. That's why you have to be very, very truthful with yourself, because most people do consider the concepts that other people have of them and call it considering other people. I can't do that, what would you think about me? It's a very, very common thought process. And that ties people to a lot of crosses that they could quite easily get off to their benefit. If they would abandon the idea of other people having a good opinion of them. And yet Shakespeare says that good name in man and woman is the immediate jewel of their soul. The most precious thing a man has is his good name to himself. But if his good name is to himself and simply not to other people, he's better off. If a man can say, I believe God exists, he knows what I am, and I know what I am, and I am trying to conform to what God thinks I ought to be, and I don't care what other people think I am, and I'm not going to act in any way to make them have an opinion of me, because I'm too busy trying to get God to have the right opinion of me by conforming to what he wants from me.
Another point you've mentioned before about your sensitivity. You reach a peak in sensitivity, you're absolutely blind to the next step. The form of despondency can creep right into your own being, and not into your shame.
Well, that's
where you look for strength then.
That is a necessary part of evolution. It's part of the experience that all the mystics have and called the dark night of the soul. You're increasing in sensitivity, and while you are doing so, there creeps in, because of your increased sensitivity, a little bit of egotism. And it says to yourself, behold, I'm increasing in sensitivity. Now that egotism immediately turns off the sensitivity and you become darkened.
Now, to get back the light, you just have to say to yourself, I turn the light on. I do. And obviously, I, as an individual, am not the cosmic intelligence. The ego, the individual self, is an object, a formal concept of oneself. Every time that thing is raised, darkness comes over the soul and the individual becomes miserable. Remember that the Absolute Spirit cannot be miserable because it is essentially omnipotent. It is all powerful, all efficient. Can't go wrong. So where misery appears, there is some identification process with the finite individual. But all the great mystics went through it. William Blake had 20 years of it. Jacob Boehme had 5 years of it. Many of them had years of it because they had said, I am doing well.
I'm very interested in something that you wrote. Just before such long, a clearness of vision comes, it seems that the left side of the down it comes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that can mean that the formal integrated pattern that you've already made as an individual is actually unable to assimilate the new experience. When you cut down the safety thing and wait to grow.
And then this darkness then can be build more strength here.
That's right, yeah. If you know that when a darkness comes, it simply means that your individual form is not ready to assimilate it, so you get on with the washing up, as other lovers would say, well, that's the best way to take it. But we are not allowed, logically, for the individual to appropriate the infinite to itself. The consciousness must let go of the finite and identify with the infinite, and then it cannot pat itself on the back. When it doesn't pat itself on the back as an individual, he cannot be miserable when he fails. The Tao Te Ching says, he who does not declare his aim cannot be said to fail.
In this sense of beauty, this is put in the middle.
Yeah.
This sense of beauty is like great sadness.
Yes.
Like the crust.
Yes. That's because you're presenting two ideas to yourself simultaneously. One, the idea of the infinite possibility. And the other, the finite actuality.
Looking forward and back at the same time.
Yes. You see, wherever there's a feeling like that, a judgment has been made. Every judgment means the presentation of two ideas, and it is the disparity between those ideas that causes despair. Despair is merely the psychological state when there is a disparity of ideas, one very high and the other low. If you see the mechanics of despair like that, you just give it up. You say, that's a disparative idea. You see the logic of the disparity and you don't be most about it.
Another point about making these things clear in your mind. An artist.
When an artist paints, the form that he puts down is words. See, a word can be sound on the ear, or printed in colored paper, or drawing, whatever it is. Word simply means a principle of order. The O-R-D in the word is the order. The W in it simply means the power, which is making the order. So if we put down a series of triangles, or squares, or circles, and build an abstract picture, it is a word. It signifies something. It is an orderly system. So, yes, say a sonata or something like that, musically, is a word in that sense.
I was working with Kerry Newman's program last night, the Harley Orchestra, in some of the cathedrals, playing the Spanish Catholic. But they were taking around the cathedral. All the forms and figures were there. And they were so interlaced with the music, still seemed to be. Moment of creation in miniature, all the men of the sky, scribes with books, and all the artists. No? Without five senses of mental feeling.
Yeah. Because music as a language, in its highest form, must dispense with the images from the five senses. What it's trying to do is get rid of all copies of the external world, real music, classical music. and is moving back to the big geometrical concept behind the particular world. As we say, bad news, silly music, Kittel music thing. If this music is about a monastery, well, then you have a background of men's feet going along in loose sandals, with an occasional ringing of dinner bell. Well, I just say that Nietzsche, by carrying out the pattern which his ancestor would impose on him, I assume, did he save his cosmopolitan? Did Nietzsche? Mm. Now you have to be careful to what you refer. Nietzsche himself, he is the product of a long line of effort. He's a reincarnation of an angel. Nietzsche's favourite idea was the idea of the eternal recurrence. And the idea of the eternal recurrence is fundamentally a simple one. You notice all the planets go around the sun in a definite time. There's no E there, that's added to make it pronounceable. And this is a kind of aspirate, that H. Only it is called a privative one, it's gentle. There are two ways of using this letter. One is, in the ancient form, we'd write one side down and one right way up. And this one we would call the spiritus asperus, the asperity. If you talk roughly to people to frighten them, that's called the spiritus asperus. This one is the spiritus asperus, which means the asperity breathing, when you intend to frighten somebody into behaving properly. That is when they're frightenable. And the upside down one is spiritus lenis, the weak spirit, where you have to charm them if they're too big to hit. Those are the two spirits. And this letter A is used for both. In Greek, we would use the letter A like that, and a comma. If we put the comma that way, it would be the spiritus asperus, and if we put the comma that way, it would be spiritus lenis, weak spirit. So, in the case of a word like the word asocial, or asocial, which means not social, really it's called a privative letter A. It deprives the word of its significance. So in the word amoral, it means not moral. But it isn't quite the same thing as unmoral or immoral. We say that the person is immoral who breaks a moral rule that he believes should be observed. But we call a man amoral, amoral, if he doesn't believe that morality has any validity at all. So there's a considerable difference between immoral and amoral. So if we wrote this, a comma that way, that would be spiritus lenis, and it would mean not. In the case of art moral, we mean not moral. And if we wrote it in this way and turned it that way, we would have to pronounce it like an H. We would say then ha. And this ha means power. You notice in the army when they're training officers to shout at the men, they teach them to throw ha up in the nose and say hum, which is the word for attention. Remember, saying hum. Now, this form here is really, in this word, to be understood as both forms, to be used alternately. So this is the same thing as the letter H. There are two forms of the H, gentle and hard. In the Old Testament, Abraham is the lenis, or gentle spirit, and Isaac is the hard spirit. Now, this M means substance, and this N means noose. So if we draw the three parts of a man like this, we put M down there, N there, and R in the middle. R men. Now, the reason it goes in this order is because, first of all, there is energy, and that energy makes matter, and then entering into that matter formulates it
as idea. Notice this is the word man as well. So the Amen means the Trinity, the gathering together of your substance, your center of energy feeling, and your nous, or nous, your intelligence. So a man has three parts. In the case of an ordinary human being, his parts are arranged like that with a spine to connect them. And I brought a pair of compasses tonight to show you, I hope this board will work, that the original form of it is done by inscribing a circle. This is the way it is actually done in the universe, where the dot in the middle is like a pebble striking the surface of the water, and this line is like a ripple moving away from it. Now, if we don't alter the pitch of the compasses, and we just shift the centre to the perimeter and draw another one in this manner, and those two fit exactly, the perimeter of the one serving as centre to the other. We then take the centre of this one, the intersection point, and we then have the Amen drawn. And you'll find that that is a very early representation of God, in which we will take the R here, and we'll take the M there, and the N there. And we'll see a very peculiar thing. When we say that this R is the middle part of a man, that is the part you feel with. Feeling, ideation, or thinking, and M for more, appetite, more. That is the conation or drive center. So here we have a feeling, here we have an idea, and here we have an appetite or urge. We call it more to keep the old-fashioned symbology. More is a very archaic word meaning appetite, drive. Now, this shows you that before a human being is made in this stretched form, stretched on the rack of time, his eternal form is a trinity like this. And you can then see the possibility of a relation. There's a relation in here where these two overlap. Here we have feeling and urge, those two. Here we have feeling and idea, and here we have urge and idea. So we have three possibilities of lapping these forms. This means that we can find in our consciousness that we are actually able to think, that is, have an idea about a feeling. We can have an idea about an urge, we can have a feeling about an urge, and we can have a feeling about an idea. So there is a link factor possible between the three parts of the being. And in the middle part here, which is the Garden of Eden, the central hidden part, these three are not divided, so that in the middle we can say is the Amen, the feeling, the drive, and the idea in the center of the being. This diagram, by simply stretching it, pulling this circle out and up, we draw one circle here, this is the M, here is the other one touching through its center. And we deliberately dislocate this one and pull it right to the top and leave a little space and put the spine on. All we've done is remove the ideation center from here and push it to the top. And we then have the temporal man, the man in time. And we will see why it is necessary for a man to be dislocated in this way. You see that here these two overlap and produce the rib cage, and then the pelvis here with your legs hanging down. There's your rib cage, and here's your pelvis. Down there is the more or appetite center, here is your feeling center, and here's your idea center. They're separated out in this manner in time so that you can learn to coordinate those things which originally were simultaneous. Now, when they were simultaneous in the state called Edenic, where Eden means actually don't judge, the state of non-judgment. This Den is Dan, judgment. The tribe of Dan in the Bible means judgment. This E, yet should be an A of a privative order. This one means don't judge. So in the state of innocence of Adam in the middle, or of the cosmic substance, there is no difference between feeling, thinking, and urging. But because of the simultaneity of it, it was difficult to control it. And therefore, in the Genesis story, it says that God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. Alone is all one. You see, they've just left out one of the letter L. Alone is the same as all one. And if you are not all one, you cannot be alone. The person who can be happy on his own is a unified person. So that the concept of aloneness, the statement by Plotinus, the flight of the alone to the alone, that is at the centre of the soul of a man, back to the absolute, is the statement about integration of the three parts, which recreate the essential unity of the man. So in the time process, man has the ideation pulled out and lifted up on this final stick, so that thinking processes occur separately in the head, without emotional contagion necessarily taking place, and he can feel without the thinking necessarily conditioning it, and also he can urge without feeling much about it. So the whole process of the unific being there is severed or dislocated in the temporal man. So the great Amen means the original center before the dislocation of these three parts, and when the parts are dislocated, that is the beginning of the time process for each person. And from that moment, the moment the child enters time, then begins the separation of thinking, feeling, and urging, so that we can actually experience in our own being the fact that we're able to think without feeling. We don't have to think when we hear the word cruelty. We don't have to feel cruelty. We can just say cruelty and leave it at that as a thought. Likewise, if we feel cruel, it does not follow that we are thinking cruelly at that moment. We might not have the word cruelty in our mind, and yet we may feel cruel, and we may hide the thought process that supports the feeling of cruelty in the process we call repression psychologically, so that we can feel cruel and yet deny in the thinking process that we are being so. And likewise, the urge center may go on doing things even though you feel that they're bad for you, because the urge center can go on eating dinner long after you're feeling fed up yourself, and long after your reason has said enough. There's a little thing that is sometimes done experimentally in biology of just cutting a little nerve here in some animals, and then the stomach goes on eating until it bursts. It does not stop. So that the fact that that nerve, when cut, allows the stomach to eat till it bursts, shows that this nerve which we cut is really having a control effect on the appetite, which if that control were absent in everybody, the stomach would always eat whatever was available and thus burst itself and perish. So we see here that these three wheels which are dislocated, and particularly the thinking one, man means to think, particularly the thinking wheel, which is dislocated and elevated and held away from the others, can be kept away from the others in order that they do not interfere with it. Because you can see that the urge center and the feeling center are very much more closely linked. Now, if we compare that with the form of the head of a wasp, its thorax, and then its abdomen, we find it has a very, very thin waist. And if we take the form of the head of an ant and its thorax and its waist, we find it tremendously thin. So in the case of the man, there's a very close relation between his feeling and his urge. In the case of these insects, these departments work quite independently. And you know, in the case of the insects, the six legs come always out of the thorax, not out of the abdomen. And if we take an ant called a warrior ant, which has big jaws and fights, it is actually possible, and is experimentally done, to cut off with a pair of forceps the abdomen without the ant stopping to fight. The ant will go on fighting, although its abdomen has been nipped off. Which shows that the mechanism of thought to do with the preservation of the ant colony is recorded not in this department, but up here. In this ideational department, out of which the weapons grow, the horns, is stored the aggression. One ancient tradition says that the mind is the organ of fear, because if we were omnipotent, we wouldn't need to think. If we were omnipotent, we would say, let there be the table laid. We wouldn't need to go and lay it. If we were omnipotent and somebody came to the door and said, you haven't paid your income tax, we'd say, let there be coinage and give him some. And if we were omnipotent, we would never be afraid. So that we think is a proof that we are not omnipotent. And that we are not omnipotent is a proof that we have need to be afraid. And fear, if allowed to express itself, begets aggression. And therefore, the aggression mechanism tends to spring out of the intellectual centre. The legs, which carry to and from things, spring out of the emotional centre. Yeah. And this part just breaks down the matter, the food, to supply you with drive power. So we see a slight difference in the form of the man and the insects, and yet they're essentially three-part beings. But in these two, the abdomen and the thorax are separated to show you that they work instinctually. And they haven't got the possibility of coordination reflexively like a man has. Their form is fixed. Whereas in the case of a man with the spinal column, with its coordinating nerves going through the centres, and with the fact that the brain is kept free from the feeling and the urge, there is a great possibility of man learning to integrate himself and thus release himself from the mechanical processes which completely determine the behaviour of the bees and the ants and the wasps. We know that the bee and the ant and the wasp have perfect social systems in which there is absolutely no individual freedom whatever. And we know that the general left-wing theory, the socialist moving towards the communist, has an idea that the state could establish something like a beehive in which every human being would work. But there's something in humanity that doesn't like the idea of being reduced to the level of a mere cog in the social machinery. This something in man is really the memory of this condition he had when he was not a member of a state, a mere cog, but a free being who has been flung into the time process to learn how to regain his freedom so that he can never again lose it. As he becomes aware of these three parts and is able to separate them out consciously so that thinking for him is thinking, not spoiled by emotion, and the feeling life is not spoiled by this urge underneath it, when he can see these three things simultaneously and coordinate them on this rod of office, the spinal cord, then his integration work is done and he is free from any external pressures. He then becomes his own master. And that is a short outline of the significance of the Amen. And I'm going to show you one of the funny things that occurs in the tradition of the devil. You can see that this center triangle gives us the possibility of integrating the three aspects of our being. And you can also see that we struck this circle and this one on the intersections of the other two. So there must be a possibility of another circle with its centre there. I won't do it on that one, I'll do another one. Because I want to show you the meaning of the Let me take a look.
No, point over.
Call that one, if you wanted to, God the Father. That is the chief. The head. Chief is Kip. Kip, captain. The head, capital. And on this side, we can do the sun. And on this side, we can do the ghost, or semblance. And we can see that if we wish to do so, there is another one here, and there's another one there, and another one there. And we can see that if we strike a circle from here, it will pass through that middle bit. If we strike a circle from here, it will pass through the middle bit. And if we strike a circle from here, it will pass through the middle bit. Now I'm going to draw one of these in just to show what happens. Now the possibilities for any being are these. It must have form to begin with. The Greek word for form is idea. That form exists in a space which is a field. The field itself. And that is experienced as feeling. And it must have urge or drive, that is substance, that's the food that we eat. Now there are three necessities of any being. There must be a field force, there must be a substance, and there must be a form. Form in substance cannot itself change unless there is a force acting upon it to induce change. So if we take the form of a billiard ball, in which there is just form and ivory there, it cannot change. But if we introduce a new force into it, then it will split. So to produce changing of substance and form, we must have these three. But we don't want more than three, because if we have more than three, we'll be introducing another one of those again from another centre. So supposing we say, here is the original, that is the field, that's force, God the force, or God the Father generator. Here is the idea, and here is the urge, or drive, substance, which you get from food. Now, the coordination centre of that requires that there be nothing else in the middle there. You want one force, one controlling idea, the master concept, one substance, unified in the middle. And remember that these are like impacts on centres in universal substance, and these are like overlapping ripples. You get these if you throw a few stones on water. You will then see these ripples intersecting each other in just this pattern. If we allow that there is another impact from here, causing a ripple to go across here, this ripple centre must be like the one over there, force. So it must contest for the middle of the being. In other words, you will have two forces in opposition in the body. And there will then be a fight between the two forces. And this fight could go on interminably, or one of them will gain the victory. And the one that gains the victory will so strengthen the vibrations of this circle in here that it completely pushes out, distorts, and gradually pushes out this one. So that eventually this triad is then under the dominion of this centre, and this one has been pushed out. Well, the one that wins defines the other one as the devil. But it isn't actually decided until the battle is finished which one is the devil. There are two forces at work. If we take the development of a child, there is first an egg, and then there appears, I won't draw a nucleus in to keep it simple, there appears a streak in it, which will become the spinal column. And one end of it becomes the head, and the other end of it becomes the belly. And this head part develops until it occupies practically all of that, until you get this little thing stuffed out there, and then they have a baby with a very big head and a very tiny little body, and until it's got lots of food pushed into the body is very, very tiny. So that when babies are born, they have very big heads. The heads do not grow very much until they've taken in a lot of food, and then it is this lower circle that grows, the belly circle taking the food. But this streak here, which becomes the spinal cord, has a positive and a negative centre. And in the development of the egg, these two centres fight. Now, if you remember in the case of the cell division, we said there was a nuclear centre, and at that centre migrated, split in two, and part went up there and part went down there, and then they started vibrating and sending messages across each other until eventually they built a wall across there. That's actually what happens in the development of any animal egg in the process of splitting. So there is a south centre and there is a north centre in the bean, and this will later form itself as the diaphragm, and here is your spinal axis. So it is always two centres fighting and producing a stress in the middle, the diaphragm, through which all the forces are being filtered. Forces from above are stopped by it, forces from below are stopped by it, so that there's any difference between the thinking centre and the drive centre from below. But one of these centres has to rule. If the man's brain rules, he defines this as the devil. But if this rules, he defines this as the devil. So when a man is under the dominion of the belly, he thinks that thinking is silly, because he's enjoying himself. And if a man becomes so dominated by the intellect that he paralyzes his activities below, he defines them as bad for him. He's not a whole being, so that the intellectual being is not really a whole being. He's merely a being in training who has been fighting the South Pole. Suppose we call that the South Pole sexuality, and the North Pole nous, intelligence. Well, then these two things are fighting. This leads us into relationships and gets us into bondage and trouble and responsibility. This one doesn't like the responsibilities, so it tries to devise ways of escape. And ultimately one of them wins. If the South Pole wins, we call him a foolish fellow who's always in trouble. But he calls himself a man who is living his life. Whereas he thinks this fellow at the top is an intellectualist who's wasting his life. But the intellectualist thinks this fellow is wasting his life, and it's Samson. I want you to understand that this question of good and evil is relative. The man at the belly level enjoying himself defines it as a good thing for him. The man in the intellect defines it as a good thing for him. But the real good is the integration centre at Amen here, which allows you at will either to have a true idea, a feeling, or an appetite in their due proportions. So the whole man is the three circulating together, and a part of a man, like party politics, cannot possibly govern the country. We must have these three for every being, and they must be harmoniously related, to which end we must, at certain points of the scale, define one end or the other as an enemy for the time being. From the point of view of a newborn baby, he gets the urge from the belly, and a message is sent up through the gullet passage to the lips, producing the so-called oral phase of stimulation in Freudian terms, so that he wants to suck and gets pleasure from it. He wants to do that so he can expand his little belly and get it bigger and bigger and bigger until he becomes a big boy. And as he's stretching this, he then becomes full grown. It is his food bag. And he puts the food in his mouth, takes it down there, breaks it down, steals the energy from the food and brings it up again here to make thought, so that he can look through his eyes to see what else there is to do. It's essential to see that the whole man is three. That the man is a trinity. He has three parts. One is an idea. He must have a true idea. He must have the right feeling, the feeling for wholeness, which is universal compassion. And he must have the right kind of substance in him, the right kind of drive. He must take the right things into him to get the right kind of energy, to give him the right kind of drive. And when he's doing those three things at once, then he's not a man of bits. He's a whole man. And to be whole is the same as being holy. You see, if we take the word whole, you notice there's a word whole in it there. That is the whole in which those three circles are inscribed. And the holy man is simply the same fellow. Now this W here is two V's lapped on each other, which mean volition or power. And when they're integrated, it means a being, because a being is an intersection of powers. So when we take a whole, there's a whole, I'll draw one, nobody uses no holes. There's a whole, and then we write inside it V and V, upside down. This is this Amen Spiritus Esper Lenis. This again is this whole being. And you can see already the Solomonic star coming back into it, which gives the balanced man. And this letter Y at the end means integration power. So a holy man is an integrated man, and an integrated man is a holy man. And in order to get that wholeness, you must integrate those three parts. In order to integrate them, you must understand what you've got. In order to understand what you've got, we've had to separate them out in time so that we can examine them separately. And then when we understand what thinking is, what feeling is, and what this drive substance is, then we can tie them all together and recreate this Edenic, or non-divided state, in the center of our being. That is the general outline of the Amen. Now, are there any particular questions you'd like to ask on this before we go any farther?
Well, there is a significance in the very word itself. The A is there because of there is a reason for the A being A.
Yes. Well, A is the head of the alphabet, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, when it says I'm Alpha and Omega, that is A and they begin. The O big, O mega, mega means big, but it means substantially big. So if we were to write A, that's a triangle originally, and O, like this, or A and O, that is Alpha and Omega, and it's a short way of drawing this. Instead of drawing that whole diagram, this is Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. Now the beginning is A, which means energy. The end of it is the O, full of substance. This is the great I Am. There's M inside there, you see. The great I Am, ideation, energy, substance. So that the letter A, which begins all the alphabetic languages, means the energy which is prior to creation, and which is itself the cause of creation. So that when it says the Alpha and the Omega, the Alpha means the energy, and the Omega is the big universe inside which everything is precipitated.
Is there any connection between
Om and Om? Well, it's really the same word. You'll notice that in this Sanskrit Om, it is frequently written A-U-M in order to pronounce it. Now, it is pronounced from the back of the mouth to the front of the mouth through the middle of the mouth. And at the back of the mouth you have a gullical sound. In the middle of the mouth you have ah, and on the lips you have mm. So really, at the back you say oh, gullical. In the middle, ah, and on the lips, mm. But you shouldn't say it serially. It isn't ah, oh, mm. It's with the lips closed, mm. Because it is essential the lips should remain closed, because that word symbolizes the whole of the big universe as a closed system. So when it is said that there is a secret pronunciation of this, the secret pronunciation of that is to keep your mouth closed. Or Masonically we say, mum's the word. Mum's the word, we say. Mum's the word means this om signifies all that is substantiated. And that is the same as the Omega of the Greeks. Now, every man was inside the big universe. You remember we did a six-pointed star to represent the big universe. Then a man inside, and then a five-pointed star inside there to symbolize the five senses. And then a little circle inside, for his consciousness of the universe. The one inside is the same as the one outside. And by means of the five sense organs, we are kept out of phase. If we had 6 points exposed to the 6 points of the universe, we would always obey it. It would be an entirely mechanical relation. We would hear the good and the true and the beautiful, and we would promptly do them because we'd have no method of avoiding it. But by having the five sense structure, we can put ourselves out of phase and thereby choose whether we will obey or not. So, in the meditation on Om, what has to be meditated is all this significance here. The Om contains these three. We could draw the circle down there and bind those together, and that is the Om.
When you spoke last week about the brothers that went from one country to another, and they called one brother called one named God,
yes,
another called it the devil, were they applying that principle?
Yes, yes. This polarity principle. See, because if you don't divide, you cannot conquer. And when you have to deal with a lot of people, supposing you employed a lot of people, you know very well that people are invariably ambitious. And everybody would like to be the boss without his responsibility, if they could find such a job. And they are, in general, irrational. That is, they are not placed up here. They're generally placed fairly low down here. So the urge centres and the crossing over of the emotive centre is about the highest point. And there, they're always trying to get their own way, but they don't know how. They can see somebody up there who's got more authority and power, and they would like it, but they don't like the responsibility, so they won't work for it. But because they would like the power, they criticize it. And therefore, he has to devise a method of filtering what these beings down below, who would like to climb on each other, really mean when they deport each other for naughtiness. The same thing goes on inside the individual body. When, if you're, supposing you're sitting near the fire and it's warm, and you know it's cold outside, but there's nothing on the television, and you know there's a good show on in town, and if you could drag yourself out of a chair to go there, through the cold air, you would get there. But there's something in you that doesn't want to be exposed to the cold. There's something else in you, quite different, that likes its toes warming at the fireplace. There's something else totally different up here, would like to see the show. And consequently, you have several beings inside you fighting. And some people may actually find themselves sitting there, fretting by the hour about whether they should go or not. Now, obviously, the thing to do to cure that condition is have one will about it and say, I'm not going, or I am going, and do either one or the other, and then refuse to regret it. Committal and refusal to regret is the key to that kind of indecision.
What is the position of a man who has both his north and south pole? Powerful, very strong.
Powerful? Well, you know, there's a very old saying, the whip passes momently from hand to hand. See, we must remember that. Because the energy in the body is changing all the time. Supposing you haven't had a meal for some time, and you've been thinking, actually the blood is high in the body. So you think, oh yes, I'm a reformed character now, you see, and then feeling very pleased, you say, well, I think I'll have something to eat. So then you drop through that hole in your face a lot of matter, which the belly works on and breaks down into energy, and while it's doing it, you begin to feel drowsy, don't you? You can't think so clearly, and you think, am I really reformed or not? You see, the blood is now flowing down to the south pole. And after a time, food is very closely related to sex. Perhaps after a time, that reformation made up there when the energy was up there cannot be supported while the energy is down here. So then something occurs which that one has forbidden, simply because the energy is floating up and down the spine at different levels. Now, sometimes a man may be educated to the point of believing, like a, say, a Puritan was, still is in certain fields. He may be told, you belong to a good family, a family who never go out with girls, don't smoke, drink, swear, back horses, dogs, or wear their hair long, or something like that. And then, that is a concept in the north centre of your being. And it starts stealing energy from the food and storing it up and getting bigger and bigger. But meanwhile, through the eyes and other modes, stimulation is reminding you, supposing we're talking about a man, that women exist. So some of the energy is going down here. Now then arises a double polarity. There's energy down there and a concept up here. That the energy down there is wrong. But the energy down there says, I'm right. Now then begins a fight. And this one starts sending impulses up the spine. This sends impulses down the spine to control it. And there occurs across the diaphragm there, generally across the diaphragm, a strain which begins to affect the breathing, and it can very rapidly affect the digestion, and if persisted in, it can result in what we would call a split personality. That is to say that alternately, one wins and then the other wins. This man down here, the John Thomas McGinty, down below, he wins a round and he feels terrible. You see, and then because he's tired, he wins the next round and feels pleased. But the moment his strength's back, he wins the next round. So as long as there's this alternation, the man feels terrible and ununified and ashamed of himself. And unless he can understand the meaning of this diagram, he cannot conquer that sort of thing, because he doesn't know that there is an actual movement of energy down and up. Now if you understand it and you want to think clearly, you will not first stuff your stomach with potatoes, because potatoes contain atropine, belladonna, which makes you feel terribly dopey and you can't think with it. So you wouldn't fill your stomach full of potatoes and then start reading Euclid, because you would promptly start nodding. And if you really want to do some work, you cut down on the kind of foods that make you dopey and you introduce into your diet more and more of the foods that make thought easy. And the foods that make thought easy are fruits, salads, and so on. So you'll find that if you eat a heavy cooked meal, you can't think so well. But if you eat salads and fruits, you'll find you can think better than you could before. This is the basis of all the restrictions on diet in all the major religions. That the fruits are very light, refined, high-frequency chemicals that aid thought. Whereas, if you take the heavier substances and heavily cook them, it takes a lot of digestion and drags the blood down in the body, and thus empowers the South Centre to dictate the policy that the body must follow, in spite of the education of the North Centre. The whole thing is a question of knowing what to do and then persuading yourself to do it. And the more you can see the truth of this integration diagram and the necessity for it, the more you will incline to do it without fighting yourself so much. If you become absolutely certain that it is essential to do this work, then you won't argue with yourself so much. But if you say to yourself, I'm not sure that it should be done, and most people seem to get on without doing it, then you will not try. And one of the best methods of reminding yourself that it has to be done, ultimately, is to tell yourself that people are arranged above each other in the relation passive-active. That active is passive to another one above him who is active. The active one always gives the orders to the passive one. So it means either you can give orders to your own organism, which means self-control, or if you cannot, orders will be given to it by other beings outside it. And this is the elementary opposition. Either you will rule yourself, or you will be ruled by some other beings who have ruled themselves. And when you think about the seriousness of that, then you will find it easier to consider working on yourself. We know for a fact that propaganda can sweep millions of people into a war, and yet that propaganda is in the hands of a few men. But if we look in to the history of those few men, we find that those few men belong to a few families who have specialized in self-control. We know that the patrician Romans, for instance, they used to have at the initiation of their boys at puberty, when they conferred upon them the toga meninis, they would have a big celebration for the servants, and they would give all the wine desired and all the food to the servants, so that the servants became disgustingly drunk and vomited all over the place. And then they would take their son, 14 years old, taking to the party when it was well going, you say, now look at those men. They have no self-control, and we have. They are the servants, we are not. They have no control, we have control. Now, if you learn to control yourself, you join us. If you won't learn to control yourself, you must belong to them. Make your choice. The child then said, I prefer to go Daddy's way, or I don't. If he said, I don't, they didn't give him the toga virilis. If he said, I like Daddy's way best, then they gave him the toga virilis. He had decided to control himself. The toga itself means the crucifixion of the gullet. So if we remember that that T-O is like circle with a cross in it, and ga is the same as ga, garbled gullet. So toga means the ability to crucify your own gullet. In other words, to curb your own appetite. Because either you will be down there, dictated to because you are drunk and incapable, or you are able to control yourself and nobody can dictate to you.
What happened with the case of men like Tolstoy who had made a battle and a problem out of such behaviour?
Well, of course, he hadn't been fortunate enough, because of the condition of Russian society at that time, to have the proper initiation that he should have had. If he had have had, then the problem would not have been so terrible for him. But Russian society had degenerated and lost a lot of the practice and these fundamental principles that had been retained elsewhere.
I'm talking about Tolstoy and the Russian zone, the people. Could that be the reason that they lost their power? Because they lost the control?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, that was so. Because actually, they started indulging their bellies when they thought they had secured their position. And you cannot stay on the top unless you deserve to stay on the top. You can't fight your way to the top and then become a belly man and roll about the ground. You see, if we consider the stories told about the wild parties before 1917, therefore it is time for the Voltaire. Remember, Voltaire was a Marquis. He was a trained man. He said, right, start a revolution. Thank you. It is time, because everybody at the top is now stopping. And there can't be a revolution until someone at the top becomes too soft.
It's like an automatic phase, then. It's automatic.
It's automatic, and it's self-moving, that is logically necessary, but if the government can't govern, it will be overthrown. And it can't govern and indulge itself at the same time.
I'm not sure on this point, but I have an idea that the people that overthrew the Russian aristocracy had been in Russia for a long time, and then they suddenly appeared there. So they
well, you know, the actual revolution movement appeared in the Russian universities. It did not appear in the people. There were certain cultural influences in the universities that did it.
I don't think Lenin had lived in Russia for a long, long time just prior to him.
Oh, no. Well, it isn't only a question of Lenin and Marx and Engels and those people. They only provided an ideology. You see, this ideological structure of Marx and Engels was borrowed by the revolutionaries because it suited their ends. If there had been another ideology equally valid, they would have borrowed that. The fact was that this was foreseen by certain people, some inside Russia and some outside, that there must be a change. And the change would come either from the people, which can only mean absolute destruction, or from the intelligentsia who have not allowed themselves to become sloppy. Therefore, it started in the universities.
So that once again, the men that appeared in the fourth book were not really the people?
Oh no, they're not the real people. They never are. The people that get their names in the paper as leaders are merely the facade for the others who don't. It's a question of elementary logic. If you ask yourself, is the position of a leader of men in times of revolution dangerous, you would say yes. Well, then, if I wish to lead something, should I show myself on a public thoroughfare, standing up in a car, waving my hand, so that a man can throw a bomb at me, or should I get a friend to do it? and the whole point about it is to find a willing substitute. Hitler and Mussolini are small fry compared with the men who put them in. You find a man with the gift of the gab and with some ambition, and you say, we have the kind of job that you would like to do. He then does it. After a time, he tries to overthrow the people who put him in, and he is then overthrown. That's vaulting ambition or leaping itself. It's the same with the trade union movement in England. You get people starting from the bottom, say like Bevan, shouting violently in the early stages of his career, and finishing up like a calm, grey-haired, old, kind man with a conservative mark all over him. Suddenly, that's the natural evolution, so well known to the Conservative Party that they actually have the nerve to print it and say that every trade union leader is a Conservative, whether he admits it or not. Although he doesn't start that way, because, as Lord Acton said, power corrupts. He has an ambition, he'd like an upper middle class house, like a baby palace, if he could get it. If he gets it, he's satisfied to keep the status quo.
And through that ambition, he can be led or pushed.
Of course, you can't lead a man without an ambition. You find a man with no ambition, you find somebody who cannot be led. Now, ambition, ambi means double, doesn't it? If a man has ambition, you can split him. Because he's already double. A man to have ambition must offer something to somebody who hasn't got something already, and he must go to those people who have it and take it off them, mustn't he? So he's two men really, isn't he? A man who's promising to reward those who support him, and a man who goes to the people who have it and tries to persuade it to give them to the men below. Now the men that have it say at a certain point, well, we won't give you 10, we'll give you 3.5 and one for yourself on the quiet. Will you persuade the men to accept that in arbitration? And he says, well, I'll try, and he goes back, and if he can manage it, he does. Because he's a middleman then, isn't he? The trade union leader is a middleman. And if there is an incorruptible man in politics, we don't know how he got there. Because you have to have an ambition to move into it. A man may start with a useful idea he'd like to do good without defining what good is. I have a friend that's entered into politics in an attempt to do good in that way. Now, he represents the typical evolution of one. First, he has no power, then he tries to do good, but underneath he really wants to do good to be valued. When he does a bit of good, he gets a little bit of value, then he feels a little bit strong, he wants to do more good for the feeling of the strength he's acquired. Then he finds he's up against other men who've already done themselves good in the past, and now start building a wall between themselves and him, and saying, if you represent the people over there that have not, well then, we will not give you what you want. But if you represent us, without admitting it, we will give you what you want, but not what they want. And this is the position of the middleman in all fields, isn't it? In the case of the Jews in Poland, we know their history. In Poland, there were two classes of people, the peasants and the aristocrats. There was no middle class. And then refugee Jews from Spain and other parts of Europe went into Poland, and because they were not peasants, they couldn't work, they were not aristocrats, but they had brought the jewels and the money with them. So they set up as moneylenders. And they lent the money to the aristocrats, not to the peasants. The peasants needed it. The aristocrats wanted it. But if nobody giving it to peasants, they'd only eat it and drink it. But if the aristocrats would give interest on it. That was the theory. Now the aristocrats borrowed and borrowed and borrowed until finally the Jews said, now what about a little bit of recognition, a little knighthood, a little tap on the head with a stick? And then they started anti-Jewish propaganda. They said to the people, you are being impoverished and trod upon by the invading Jews. And so at one blow they removed the people to whom they owed money and the social problem of what to do with the middle class that shouldn't be there. They actually wrote them together and burned them in the hundreds. The peasants did the job, and they were triggered off by the aristocrats who had borrowed the money. It's one of the European black spots. But if those people hadn't have gone in there with that intent in the first place, it couldn't have happened to them. Things happen to people because people move in specific ways. If you don't like what happens to you, move in another way.
I get the idea all the time of souls for mammon.
Well, mammon means count
the spirit, isn't it?
Mammon means count the material side of it, doesn't it? Man means count. Yeah. Is that what it means? Mum is material. Mammon means count the material side. You have mammon on one side and freedom on the other. You cannot serve the free and the bound at the same time. Mammon is bound and God, Spirit, is free. So you cannot be free if you are selling yourself at the same time.
You're really going in whichever direction the carriage is held, it's good for
you. Of course. Which is all the same thing as being in the donkey position.
I remember you saying once that the sage is not a free man yet.
The sage? The sage is self-bound, isn't he? He binds himself to the universal truth to escape the temporal lie. Doesn't he? Supposing I understand that a certain law exists called the law of inertia. And I know that in the time world it means, psychologically, that the mind of a man, once being made up, he cannot unmake it himself. A stimulus from outside will have to unmake it for him, otherwise he will remain in eternal bondage. Which is the meaning of religious education, tradition and so on. A stimulus from outside to release a man from the established erroneous ideas that time has given him. Christ calls them the dead, the men of the inertic mind. They are dead men, they are in the groove, they can't get out. You have to hit them. So that you have to put yourself under something, either rubbish or the truth. If you put yourself under the temporal, phenomenal presentation, you are a slave to the time process. If you put yourself under universal truth, well then you are cooperating with the universal truth. You obey it, but you do it deliberately, because it's better. St. Paul says we are of the law, not under it. Of the law means we affirm there is a universal law, because we know that it's affirming us. We agree with it. We are not under it. Let us say the law of inertia is such that although it exists, we can utilize it. And that's a person in the temporal process cannot.